This is the news roundup on CAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, March 21st. We'll be discussing the week's top local stories with reporters and editors from around the region. Today on the program, we'll be hearing from CAI's Jeanette Barnes and Eve Zukoff. We'll speak with Unki Sanu of the Martha's Vineyard Times and Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. We'll hear from William Von Herf of the Provincetown Independent and Jason Graziadei of Nantucket Current. And we'll speak with Anastasia Lennon of the New Bedford Light. Now to some of the news around the Cape, the coast, and the islands. South Coast Rail is scheduled to open Monday with service to New Bedford and Fall River. State officials plan to ride trains from both cities and then to meet in Taunton for a press conference. CAI's Jeanette Barnes has been covering South Coast Rail for years and joins us now to talk about all of the latest details and some of the history, too. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi, Steve.
So train lines don't get extended very often. This was a massive undertaking, cost about $1 billion. Take us back a little bit and tell us how the state made the commitment to do this.
Okay, this is like a whirlwind tour of past governors, but I will be quick. So the state started committing some funding to this in the 90s under Governor Bill Weld. And then in 1998, Governor Paul Cellucci held a groundbreaking in Fall River. That is the story that Senator Michael Rodericks and some others like to tell about receiving ceremonial shovels from that way back in 98. And I'm told some people actually have three shovels from different groundbreakings for this. But it continued on. Then when Governor Romney came in, Governor Mitt Romney, he said that the state had no money for South Coast Rail. And that really put the whole thing on hold for a few years. People were wondering if the state would ever really pay for the train to come down to the South Coast. Governor Patrick was elected. He was in office and recommitted the state to doing it, but it still was not fully funded. He was in office for 8 years, so you can see how the decades are kind of slipping by here. And meanwhile, the cost was rising. The cost estimate went up to $3.4 billion. Then under Governor Baker, there really was a turning point because the state decided to split South Coast Rail into two phases. And that really was a way to make it a lot cheaper by extending the line from Middleborough south instead of from Stoughton. That's what's now called Phase One. It is less direct and less complicated, a little longer ride. But now that's what's opening now, phase one, as they call it. And Governor Healey, governor number six in this list, gets to open the train, which is kind of interesting because when all this started, she was still an undergraduate in college. So no one had that on their bingo card.
So to accomplish this, six new train stations have been built. And you've seen all of them in person as you've done your reporting. They're in quite a variety of different settings, right? And some are in more of a neighborhood setting, some are not. Tell us about the stations and where they're located.
Yeah, that's right. They are very different. So some of them are in areas where there are homes, apartments, stores relatively nearby, even if it's a little bit of a walk. And those are the two stations in New Bedford is like that. So is Fall River. And Middleborough as well. I talked with some neighbors around those stations, including a few that are in the feature story that we have airing today. In Fall River, there's a bakery next to the train station that just opened last year. I chatted with one of the owners there. Certainly he's looking to see if that brings a new business to town. But there are some other stations that are not as walkable, and those are particularly East Taunton and Freetown. East Taunton is kind of near where the old Taunton Mall site used to be. It's at the end of an industrial road. The only neighbor I could find there was a commercial trucking facility. And then in Freetown, the station there, the address is South Main Street, but it's not very main in that area. It's kind of winding. There's a few houses and some industrial properties there. It's by the Stop and Shop distribution center. So there are a couple that really are not in the kind of place most people would walk to.
The name of what was called the Middleborough Lakeville line has been changed to the Fall River New Bedford line because the lines are named after the last station. But this isn't just one line here that we're talking about. It forks into two branches as you head south, which adds some complexities to the whole schedule. Explain how that works.
Yes, so South Coast Rail is like two lines south of Taunton, and then they become one in at the East Taunton station. And when you look at the schedule of trains originating from New Bedford and Fall River, they're staggered, right, which makes sense. One's leaving at one time, a little later one leaves from the other city. But so what if you are trying to get out of Boston at a certain time, you're heading to Fall River, but the train you need actually goes to New Bedford or vice versa? They have created a train shuttle that you can take. So you would get off in East Taunton, and using that same ticket that you already have, which is a Zone 8 ticket, you can then take a shuttle train that's running to whichever city the primary train is not running to. So as long as people are comfortable with that little switch in trains there, they will be able to get to their destination. But I've been thinking a little bit especially for our listenership, about what is the most practical, what is the most convenient thing to do. Of course, it depends on exactly where you live, but for like the eastern part of the South Coast, say Marion or Wareham, and certainly on Cape Cod, you probably would still have a shorter overall ride to Boston if you drove to Middleborough versus going west to New Bedford and then having a longer train ride.
Mm. In the big picture, really, this has the potential to change how the region connects up to Boston. The state announced yesterday that South Coast Rail will be free for the rest of March. It sounds like they're encouraging people to get acquainted with this new service. Tell us about, even as we move beyond the free period here, tell us about how the pricing and the ticketing will work.
Sure, you are right. It's they've announced it's free on weekdays through the end of March, and then free on weekends also through the end of April. The state said parking could be free as well through the end of April, but they're reserving the right to change that if the lots are constantly filling up. So after that, once you are actually paying the regular rate, the train ticket pricing is for Zone 8, which is $12.25 each way on weekdays. They do have this weekend kind of deal that's pretty good. It's a $10 pass for unlimited rides both days on the weekend. Mm-hmm. To buy these tickets, the MBTA recommends now that people use the app if they can. That's definitely the recommendation. It's called M-Ticket, the letter M, ticket. You can, however, still buy tickets on the train, and they do take credit cards on the train as well if you need to do that. If you're not comfortable with the app, or you just don't want to, download it for the infrequent times that you're going to be using this. So those are the ways to get the tickets. They also have another app for folks who are really interested in doing this. It's called MBTA Go. And that one does live tracking of the trains. It gives live arrival times. It will give you closure alerts and things like that.
If all this goes according to plan, Monday is the big day. That's when the trains will start running. The state is not missing an opportunity to celebrate here. Can you talk about the plans?
Yes. Although the trains will be starting with the actual first trains of the day, which are very early, 4:27 a.m. In New Bedford and 5:05 in Fall River, all the officials are coming down for celebration starting at 10 o'clock. Governor Healy and the general manager of the MBTA, that's Phil Eng, will be in Fall River for some sort of opening celebration that starts at 10, and then they will be riding the 10:38 train from Fall River to East Taunton. Over in New Bedford, they will have the Lieutenant Governor Kim Driscoll and the Secretary of Transportation, Monica Tibbetts-Nutt. They also will be doing something there at the station starting at 10 and then riding the 10:43 from New Bedford to East Taunton. Of course, both of those trains will be arriving there. They will be converging, getting off, and doing some kind of a press conference there at the East Taunton station. I know that they certainly will not be the only ones riding. There will be plenty of media on those trains. We'll see plenty of information about how that goes down after all these years, And I'm sure that some of those politicians, local politicians, and other officials will be on those trains as well. After three groundbreaking shovels, you are definitely going to want to ride that train.
That is CAI's Jeanette Barnes. Jeanette, thanks.
Thanks, Steve.
Last week, for the first time this year, a North Atlantic right whale mother-calf pair was seen in Cape Cod Bay. CAI's Eve Zukoff says since then, more whales have followed. She joins us now. Hi, Eve.
Hi, Steve.
Tell us about this first mother-calf pair that made it to Cape Cod Bay.
Sure. So the mother-calf pair, this begins with right whale mother, whose name is Nauset, actually. She is named for the lighthouse in Eastham. She was seen with her calf on March 11th, about 5 miles west of Great Island in Wellfleet. These two were actually first seen off the coast of Georgia in December. So we are talking about a 1,500-mile journey for like a 4-ish-month-old baby calf.
Don't envy the mother.
No, yes. Oh my gosh. And the pair successfully migrated north to the feeding grounds of Cape Cod Bay. Now, Nauset is 31 years old. This is her fifth known calf, which is a lot for this species. And it's pretty cool. Her 2013 calf named Monomoy was also seen on Cape Cod Bay, in Cape Cod Bay, excuse me, on the same day. So all her babies were around.
Now, since that sighting on March 11th, you reached out to your sources to find out if more whale babies were in local waters, right whale babies specifically. What did you find?
Yeah, I got a note from Amy James, who's a researcher with the Center for Coastal Studies. She said that they have seen a second mother calf pair arrive in the bay, captured opportunistically, is how she characterized it, basically like by sheer luck, by one of the research boats from Center for Coastal Studies. That was a mom named Blackheart, and she had her 2025 calf with her. That's her second documented calf. As of this week, the Center for Coastal Studies overall has documented 125 individual right whales so far this season in Cape Cod Bay, which is about a third of the total population of North Atlantic right whales. The weather has kept the aerial spotting team down, so there could be more individuals. And actually, if people are interested, these whales might be able to be seen from shore. They're mainly feeding below the surface at the moment, James told me, but there are some large groups that are feeding up at the surface. You could see them specifically from Race Point and Herring Cove in Provincetown.
Now it is spring, so to talk about young animals being born, and this is the season for renewal, but actually, why is it such a big deal to mark these first mother calf pairs as they appear?
Well, each year there's so much bad news about North Atlantic right whales. They are critically endangered, the most endangered whales in the world, 370 or so left. Entanglement in fishing gear and other rope in the ocean, and ship strikes, collisions with boats, are taking them out in really high numbers. And that's after whaling really decimated the population. So the thing to celebrate is the calves. And this winter's calving season, 20 babies, 20 calves were seen in the calving grounds in the southeastern U.S. But reaching Cape Cod Bay indicates that they've marked a crucial step in their development. Again, 1,500 miles some of them swam. They're strong. They've made it here to feast in Cape Cod Bay to get stronger. It's protected habitat here. This is a big deal.
I want to talk about another story that you reported this week. It's a study that looks at how whales transport nutrients across the ocean. Tell us about the so-called Great Whale Conveyor Belt.
Sure. So researchers from the University of Vermont, our neighbors, kind of, they published findings in Nature Communications, this journal. They basically started with the premise that humpback whales and gray whales make the longest distance migrations of any mammal on the planet, thousands of miles each year. And through their urine, feces, placentas, carcasses, and sloughing skin, these whales, they knew ahead of this study, are bringing nitrogen and other nutrients from high latitude areas like Alaska and Antarctica to low nutrient tropical grounds like Hawaii and the Caribbean. But this study is the first one that the authors are aware of that tries to quantify how much nutrients are being moved by these whales. And they found that, in fact, humpback, gray, and right whales transport more than 3,700 tons of nitrogen each year while migrating along what you said has been dubbed the Great Whale Conveyor Belt. This is basically saying whales are the bees of the ocean. They are pollinating the same way that those critical small little creatures do.
Talk about that a little bit more. What happens when they bring these nutrients to these low nutrient areas?
Well, the nutrients can be picked up by phytoplankton, coral reef systems, fish, birds, and they have a really big impact on these distant ecosystems all around the world. And specifically, the impact on phytoplankton is really important because it takes in carbon dioxide, it expels oxygen, and it makes up the base of the marine food web. Now, I will say ocean currents and upwellings also transport nutrients, but only at a fraction, only a fraction as much as what whales are able to do in their natural migratory patterns. So this research overall informs this argument for stronger whale conservation, according to the authors. They said basically as whale populations have declined over the last few centuries, the great whale conveyor belt has really weakened. The nutrient transport numbers by the tons might have been three times higher before commercial whaling.
Okay, I want to talk about one more story, a story that you covered last week about a particularly curious piece of property for sale along a coastal road in Falmouth. First, just describe it for us and tell us how it came to your attention.
Sure. So this is 410 Surf Drive in Falmouth. It's a property in one of the most picturesque areas of Falmouth, really iconic stretch. And when you come to this waterfront property, you see something that jumps out at you. A lot of people kind of stop by it. You can notice it. There are 10 wooden posts. They look like telephone poles just sticking up out of the sand with a couple of cross beams on top. It's a set of weathered pilings on 2,200 square feet of loose sand. And it's on sale for almost $600,000. I actually heard it mentioned on The Point, our show here at CAI, by a coastal resilience expert. And it got me thinking about coastal property and what it means to see something like this for sale at more than $500,000. And the real estate agent was willing to talk with me.
So a tiny square of sand with some pilings there, not much there in terms of if you're looking for coastal property, and yet it's got a big price tag attached to it. You mentioned that it's on Surf Drive. A while back, you were on the news roundup talking about how the town was looking at this very specific area with an eye towards what's called managed retreat, which explain what this is about.
Yeah, well, the road on Surf Drive is often overwashed with sand. The beach is eroding. The nearby neighborhood often faces flooding. So scientists say the frequency and severity of these threats will only increase with climate change, right? So a report from 2020 by a coastal engineering firm that was commissioned by the town of Falmouth suggests that within 25 years, the town should start phasing out services to private homes on Surf Drive. This is the concept of managed retreat, that when the ocean is telling you what to do, you have to listen at some point. It's time to move infrastructure out of the way. And also the report says that within 50 years, the pavement on the road should be removed, allowing really what's there to go back to nature.
So this little tiny piece of sand with some posts on it, is it really expected to sell then?
Yeah. I mean, we can look to other examples. A beachfront home on Nantucket, once valued at more than $2 million, sold about 8 months ago for $200,000. Not a lot, but it was to a buyer who knew it was on the verge of falling into the sea. Now, in January, after just one season of use, it was condemned and demolished. But I think that people really paid attention to that story because it really said something. Now, this 410 Surf Drive has been on the market for over 300 days, so we will see. But the realtor told me that she has a couple ideas for what could happen to it eventually. She said the property could be handed to a conservation organization, or someone could turn the pilings into like a summer cabana, basically hang a sheet over top and have people sitting underneath for $500,000 worth of shade. Or someone could do what about a dozen of the neighbors have done, which is build an elevated 400 square foot cottage, though it would require a whole bunch of permitting, due diligence, and it could not have a bathroom.
For $500,000, no bathroom. CAI's Eve Zukoff, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
This is the News Roundup on CAI. I'm Steve Junker. We'll take a quick break now. When we come back, we'll speak to Unki Sanu of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Stay with us. This is the News Roundup on CAI. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with reporters and editors from around the region. I'm Steve Junker. Our next story is a hard one to talk about. It involves the death of a toddler on Martha's Vineyard stemming from apparent neglect while the child was in the care of a paid babysitter. It's going to take us about 5 minutes to talk about if you would prefer to step away and rejoin us in a moment. Unki Sanu of the Martha's Vineyard Times is here with that story. Thank you for joining us, Unki.
Hi, Steve.
This incident happened last Thursday, a week ago, and the child was flown to Boston for care and died this week. Tell us about what we know about how this came about.
So as far as we know, an Opelous woman, Amy Cotton, she was taking care of two children, and she apparently left them in her car for several hours, and the two-year-old boy was found, you know, not breathing, and blue, and she was attempting to do CPR when police arrived. The kid had to be airlifted off the island to Mass General Hospital, but unfortunately he succumbed to his injuries and passed away.
It's a terrible story on so many levels here, but one of the things that came out as the police started to try to unpack what happened here is that the babysitter, Amy Cotton, when she first called them and was explaining what happened, she said that she had the children in the house with her, but there was a camera that was recording, I guess, the driveway and where the car was parked. And when police looked at this footage, they understood that what she was telling them was apparently not true.
Yes, that's what was said, and as such by the prosecutor. The lady told them that she had them in the house and was only away from them for a short time, but a security camera that oversaw the area of where a car was, this apparently showed to the investigator that the children were left unattended for several hours. And apparently the prosecutor says that this isn't a first-time incident either. Apparently this had just kind of unwatchfulness has occurred before.
So the children were left unattended in the car for several hours through the morning is what the prosecutor is saying here, and saying that the security footage demonstrates this. Where does it go now for, I guess, the woman who's charged here? Is she out on bail?
Yeah, so after the boy died, the judge escalated her charges to include manslaughter, and her bail shot up from $2,800 to $21,000, which hasn't posted, but she does have to wear like a GPS monitor, and there are curfews. She can't, she has to stay away from the alleged victim's family and is currently banned from having any daycare or childcare activities going on. But, it's just an awful situation, and I think everyone agrees that condolences should go out to the family as well.
It is an awful situation, and we send our thoughts out. I want to ask you about one other story. The paper you work for, the Martha's Vineyard Times, announced that it is the recipient of a unique grant, a significant chunk of money, which will allow it to create a full-time position for a local island journalist. Explain what's happened.
So, John and Michelle Battelle have pledged a three-year, $150,000 grant to the MV Times, and this was announced this past weekend, during our Islanders Right event. And the gift will be used to help fund the next generation of writers and reporters on the island. And it also helped to establish a new position for us called the Island Writer, which is a way to kind of recruit from younger people who currently are from and live on the island and who can report on their community. And this is kind of an extension of what we've already been doing. We've had interns, we've had the High School View, which is the newspaper for the local high school, running in our paper at times, and it's a really generous gift that was a matching / augmented grant for a fundraising effort that was done over the winter.
That is Unki Sunu of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Unki, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
impacts of federal decision-making in Washington, D.C. continue to be felt locally. The Lower Cape is seeing its share. Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle has details and joins us. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Steve.
A plan to resume the launching of weather balloons in Chatham has been shelved, it seems, as the National Weather Service is facing big cutbacks.
Yeah, exactly. The town, specifically the Airport Commission, has been working with the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration for a couple years now to establish a new weather balloon launching station at the airport property. You may recall that there was a weather balloon launching station at the Monomoy Wildlife Refuge property on Morris Island, but that closed in April 2021 after, as erosion was encroaching on that property and the facility there was torn down. And, that left kind of a hole in the data gathering. For the upper air information, every day, a couple times a day, the staff down there would launch these weather balloons that go way up into the upper atmosphere and send back, atmospheric information about all sorts of data like wind speed, humidity that is fed into the computer models that we all end up seeing as the forecast. The Weather Service really wanted to reestablish a station in Chatham. They spent a lot of time working with the Airport Commission. They were really on the cusp of finalizing a 20-year lease agreement for property on the airport when they were notified just recently that the project is on indefinite hold. Huntley Harrison, who's the chair of the Airport Commission here in Chatham, said it was basically because the NOAA couldn't commit to the project because of the uncertainty of federal funding. And his sense is that the project is probably dead at this point.
You have another story that, interestingly, seems to be going the other direction. It's about a federal agency buying a building in Chatham to anchor its offices and local services.
Yeah, this was kind of a surprise to us. We're going back to the Monomoy Wildlife Refuge, where their visitor center and offices had to be demolished about a year ago because of the erosion down there. And they had been searching, the Fish and Wildlife Service had been searching for at least a year for new headquarters because they knew this was going to happen. And we hadn't heard anything for a number of months. And when the Doge folks started their cutting down in Washington, D.C., we figured that project would probably be sidelined. But we learned last week that the Fish and Wildlife Department of the Interior actually purchased a property on Main Street in Chatham for over $3 million. To house a new visitor center for the refuge, as well as offices and a couple of apartments that will house the interns that they bring down to the island every summer to monitor the shorebirds. Apparently they had budgeted the money previously, and this project sort of was in the works before any of the major cuts started to happen in Washington. So it went through. The property transfer happened March 5th. So we don't know exactly when they'll be opening those refuge visitor center and offices. The building was recently completely renovated following a fire. So it's sort of all ready to move in, but we haven't seen much activity there in the past couple of weeks other than some finishing up on the exterior of the building. So, and the Fish and Wildlife Service didn't respond to our inquiries about when this office would be open. But I would expect that it'd be open probably for the summer since, like I said, it was in pretty much move-in condition. So that's a positive federal development down here, which I think we have to take those wins when we can get them.
It's Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thank you.
Thanks very much, Steve.
Last week, fire burned about 14 acres in Fort Hill in East Ham. It didn't make big headlines because it was intentional. It was a prescribed burn. William Von Herf of the Provincetown Independent joins us to explain. Hi, William.
Hello, how are you doing?
This area is part of the National Seashore, and these kinds of burns, I guess they used to be more of a regular occurrence.
That's right. The former fire management officer, David Crary Jr., he had been working for the seashore for decades, and under his he was regularly doing controlled burns all across the seashore, including on Fort Hill. He told me that during his time, they aimed to burn half of Fort Hill every year in order to keep that burn regimen up.
He left, and this burn regimen has not been maintained over the last few years. This is the first time it's been done in a little while.
That's right. David Crary retired at the beginning of 2022, and before then was the pandemic. David explained to me that it was very difficult for them to do burns in 2020 and 2021. So this is really the first major burn that the seashore has had since 2019. And the reason for that is that following David's retirement, the seashore did try to hire new fire personnel, but there was a lot of difficulty associated with finding qualified staff were able to, at least as they outlined it to me, they were able to find housing. And now, thanks to the executive order that Trump passed in the first day of his tenure in the White House, they're not able to fill those roles anymore because no unfilled roles in federal positions are allowed to be filled for the time being.
It seems almost counterintuitive to set a wildfire somewhere and hope to contain it. Explain what the purpose is here and why this is actually a tool that people are using to maintain these properties.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Fire is one of those things that's, we don't like to think of it this way, but wildfire is natural. The entire existence of grasslands throughout the East Coast is, you can pretty much attribute it to wildfires. Without wildfires, every bit of land would grow into scrubby, dense underbrush or really old forests. Fires allow that land to open up, and there are so many animal and plant species that can only exist in those areas. And Fort Hill is one of the rare grasslands on the Outer Cape because so much of the Outer Cape grew into forests due to fire suppression. No fires were allowed to burn, disturbances were allowed, and all of a sudden, you know, if you walk around the National Seashore, it's pretty much a sea of pitch pines. And the Fort Hill is one of the exceptions to that. And the reason that it's been maintained like that is a combination of and fire. And what the fire does in this sort of environment is, well, one thing, it burns through all the dead grasses and turns it into ash, which are, you know, really good nutrients for plants to grow in. It also kills a lot of the non-native plants that, if left unchecked, will choke out the native species. Now, that doesn't mean that necessarily that those non-native species won't come back, but it at least gives the native species more room and time to grow up again. So in this case, as Karen Copper, who is a fire ecologist, explained to me, there's likely to be a lot more green vegetation, a lot more wildflowers on the side that was burned come the spring.
Okay, now I want to ask you about how this actually gets accomplished. If you're going to burn a big area, 14 acres, and not have that fire take off on you, were you out there? Did you get to see some of this? Did you see how they do this?
Very lucky that me and our staff photographer, Emily Schiffer, we got to go out and watch much of the burn happen. It was really cool to see. I have to admit, it's something that I'd wanted to see for a long time, and it was very interesting to watch in real life. And I think to answer your question, the first part was that the crew is massive. It was a good 20 people out there from all over the national park system. There are people from Delaware Water Gap and from New River Gorge, Acadia. And what really happens is you have one person who's designated as the burn boss who manages this. And then before the burn even starts, there's weeks, if not months of preparation, writing a burn plan, outlining how you want the fire to go, the parameters of temperature and wind speed that need to exist in order for the fire to burn properly. And when the fire is actually going, well, first you have to protect the whole area. They mowed a perimeter around it super to make the grass super short, and then raked all the vegetation out of it so it created a fire break. And along the shrubbery on the outside, they doused it in water and ran a hose along the outside. They had people with water backpacks and a big sort of, I didn't get the name of it, but a stick with sort of a rubber end that you can use to pat out embers. And they were going very slowly. They made sure the fire fully burn as it was going instead of just rushing across the grassland. And that had ecological benefits because it meant that the thatch layer really properly burned, but it also meant that the fire didn't get out of control.
There must have been a moment early on, it sounds like, when they had to decide if this, they had put all these pieces in place, but were they going to actually do this? And so much was dependent on the weather. If it's too windy, you can't do something like this.
Yeah, so that's right. So originally the burn was intended to start around 10 a.m., but by 11, they were still not sure if they were going to be able to get the burn going. I'm not sure if you all remember the weather from, was about 9 days ago now, but it was a crazy windy day. And they were concerned that the wind was going to be too high, and it was also quite cold. So you kind of had concern going in both directions a little bit. But primarily the issue was that with the wind, the fire would get out of control or just not really function properly. So by 11:20, they thought, okay, the parameters are good enough. This isn't something that was really officially confirmable, but anecdotally, Hill kind of provided a windbreak a little bit to the side that they were burning on. And they lit a test fire at like 11:20, and they watched how it burned, and it seemed to be burning well, and there were no obvious issues. And so they started the full fire, and it was very exciting to watch what started as a very, you know, a fire over an area no larger than maybe a dinner table, all of a sudden become this big line of fire going across the field.
That is William Von Herf of the Provincetown Independent, where you can find his article on this, and you can also see the photographs. William, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
You're listening to the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll hear from Jason Grazide of Nantucket Current. Stay with us. This is the local news roundup on CAI. I'm Steve Junker. We are talking about the top local stories of the week with the journalists who cover them. On Nantucket, a controversial coastal protection project at the Sconset Bluff has been given the okay by town officials to expand. Jason Grazide of Nantucket Current has more details on this. Hi, Jason.
Good morning.
These are the so-called geotubes, which at one point were under court order to be removed. Is that right?
Yeah, these geotubes, which were installed at the base of the Sconset Bluff in 2014, have been controversial, you know, for, you know, even before they were installed. People are concerned about the impact they could have in accelerating erosion north and south of the installation. The organization that paid to install them, the Sconset Beach Preservation Fund, which includes a number of property owners along the Sconset Bluff, had been maintaining this for a number of years, and they were required to add sacrificial sand just for that purpose to, sustain the beaches northward and southward of the installation. They fell behind significantly in years prior on the sand contributions they were supposed to make, which led to, as you said, the order to remove them. But a lot has happened since that order, what came down in 2021 and was actually upheld by a judge. Membership of the Conservation Commission has changed. The select board installed a number of new members and then actually partnered with the Conservation Fund to the proposal to expand the geotubes significantly northward and southward from the original installation. So that is what the Conservation Commission ruled on yesterday, was okaying this project. But as we've come to learn with this, the story's never over. And soon after the approval came down from this Conservation Commission last night, the Sconset Beach Preservation Fund immediately sort of objected to what was in there in terms of how much sacrificial sand needs to be made up from the prior years and be contributed moving forward. So even if this goes ahead, it still needs to be approved by town meeting voters in terms of the lease that will be required. So there's a number of steps down the road for this project in terms of whether we actually see it expanded to the extent which it was approved for yesterday.
Let me ask you about another large contentious project. This is a development that's been under consideration for the island for years. It's still a source of contention. The ZBA sounds like it's no closer to approving this. This is Surfside Crossing.
Yeah, this is another controversial one. This has been, you know, we probably talked about this a number of times because it's been pending since 2018 and has had a acrimonious journey through the regulatory gauntlet. and, you know, was appealed by the original approval, which was scaled back by the Zoning Board of Appeals, was appealed to the Housing Appeals Committee, a state agency. They okayed the project, triggering further appeals, and a judge actually remanded this back to our zoning board for further review. This is a 156-unit condominium project proposed as a 40B development in the Mid-Island area on South Shore Road. And the zoning board over the past 6 months has been, you know, looking at this closely again, and, you know, heard from a number of people in the community with concerns and sort of conflicting opinions about whether the project adhered to stormwater standards, whether our fire department could handle and, you know, respond to a fire in the development as densely constructed as this one, as well as potential impacts it could have on our aquifer. And on Wednesday this week, the zoning board began its deliberations and was quickly became apparent that they are going to deny this project, setting the stage for, you know, yet another appeal by the developer up to the state agency, the Housing Appeals Committee.
Mm. Hey, I want to ask you about a Nantucket summer resident who made big headlines yesterday with the news that he will be buying the Boston Celtics for a record sum.
Yeah, that's right. Bill Chisholm, who owns a house on Nantucket, is the lead of a leader of an investor group that probably everyone heard about yesterday, has purchased the Boston Celtics for $6.1 billion pending approval by the NBA's Board of Governors. So as we mentioned in our story today, now Nantucket is the summer home to both the owner of the Celtics and the Red Sox, as John Henry purchased a place out here on the island in 2022. You know, I don't think Bill Chisholm has kept a very high profile on Nantucket. I don't think a lot of people even knew his name or knew that he owned a house out here. But sort of interesting to hear him come up and the connection to Nantucket.
It seems like everything ties back there eventually. It's Jason Grazide of Nantucket Current. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on.
This is the local news roundup on CAI. I'm Steve Junker. The Boston Globe's investigative reporting team, called the Spotlight Team, is out with a new series of stories, and these focus on New Bedford's police department. They include numerous allegations of questionable conduct, specifically naming the man who is the current police chief. The police department and the mayor have pushed back on these stories. Anastasia Lennon of the New Bedford Light has more and joins us now. Hi, Anastasia.
Morning, Steve. Thanks for having me.
The Spotlight series is called Snitch City, and it points to, among other things, abuses in how police used criminal informants. Tell us a little bit more about what they're pointing at here.
Yep. So the series, it's a podcast, it's a written component, but it goes back decades to when the NAP police chief Paul Vera worked in narcotics. And through the decades, it traces allegations and concerns about how this department, which, you know, builds drug cases, seizes drugs in the city, how it uses confidential informants, misuses them specifically to you know, prosecute these cases. And they focus on, you know, three officers, two are current, including the chief, and one is former, who earned the nickname Officer Pills for, you know, allegedly stealing drugs off people on the waterfront. And yeah, some serious allegations there.
They also point to FBI investigations that have been underway at different times over the past years into the department.
That's right. So the Standard Times back in the early 2000s, they did report a drug defendant was alleging that the federal government, FBI, DEA tapped him to, you know, get information on corruption in the New Bedford Police Department, including on Paul Vera, who's now the chief. And the Globe also reports that in as recent as 2017 and 2022, the FBI was also inquiring about Paul Vera and the department with regards to corruption and, you know, misdoings in the narcotics unit.
Now, the mayor's office and the police department there in New Bedford have come out with statements in response to all of this. Tell us a little bit about what they're saying.
Yeah, so the mayor's taken an issue with even the title of the series, Snitch City. He sees it as derogatory. He doesn't appreciate how the Globe has characterized the city, but he also says that the series is materially incomplete, and he takes a jab at its use of criminals as sources. You know, the Globe did speak with confidential informants. But, you know, the department itself uses these same informants who are convicted criminals to build their own cases. So, you know, he's criticizing their use, but it's also a technique and tool that the department itself uses.
And the department has an actual sort of web page together to answer a number of these allegations.
Yep, they titled it For the Record, and so it's a lengthy web page where they've even linked to some documents that they've shared with the Globe. So, you know, they push back on some claims. They're saying some aspects are false, or they're providing more context. So, yeah, they are really pushing back on this series. The mayor has said he's forwarded it to the FBI and that they've hired an expert in internal affairs, though they haven't disclosed who this expert is or when they hired them, to look specifically into the internal affairs unit, which, you know, holds officers, is supposed to hold officers accountable and issue discipline for when they do engage in misconduct. But they're also going to be investigating the criminal bureau that's responsible for these narcotics cases.
And we should say that the chief, Paul Oliveira, is going to be retiring.
Yep. So the announcement of his retirement came last month, and that was about a month after the Globe released its first teaser trailer for this series. And so he's retiring a few years earlier than his contract was supposed to expire, but the city and the chief maintain, you know, he's maxed out on how much he can earn in retirement once he turns 55 years old next month. So they're saying, you know, this was in the works for him to step down, and he will be leaving the department as chief effective in May.
Another police-related story that you covered, a former officer who accused the city of retaliation for reporting alleged gender abuse has been awarded damages. Tell us what happened here.
Yep. So this case, I covered it when it started in 2021, but a former female officer, Michaela Saunders, with the department, she filed a civil suit against the city and a few high-ranking officers alleging gender discrimination and retaliation. And, you know, it wrapped up just this week with a jury trial. The count for alleging gender discrimination was dismissed, so the jury only delivered a verdict affirming the plaintiff, the former officer, her claims of retaliation. So the jury determined that the city has to pay $50,000 for emotional distress and another $77,000 in, you know, lost wages that she would have, you know, received had she continued working with the department. And interestingly, she wants to return to the department and is hoping to use anti-discrimination law to her benefit to get a position back there. So, you know, Superior Court judge still has to issue a final, you know, judgment on the whole case to wrap it up. But the jury has come out in the former officer's favor that she was retaliated against.
And she speaks about how difficult it was for her to come forward with this and why she ultimately felt it was so important.
Yeah, you know, I think everyone knows that policing is a rather male-dominated field, and, you know, there are other allegations of gender discrimination, not New Bedford, but elsewhere, by female officers, and there aren't many female officers in New Bedford, so she really made a point in saying not only did she do it for herself, but she wanted to make sure that, you know, this hopefully doesn't happen to other people and discourages you know, what she feels she experienced as a woman in that department.
It's Anastasia Lennon of the New Bedford Light. Anastasia, thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
That's our show for today. I want to thank all my guests. We heard from CAI's Jeanette Barnes and Eve Zuckoff. We spoke with Unki Sanu of the Martha's Vineyard Times and Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle, William Von Herf of the Provincetown Independent, Jason Graziadei of Nantucket Current, and Anastasia Lennon there from the New Bedford Light. Big thank you to Dan Treidel for engineering the program. With news stories taking off and landing all program long, he's the air traffic controller with an unerring sense of timing. Thanks, Dan. That's all we've got. In Woods Hole, I'm Steve Junker. Talk to you next week.